Other juveniles had accompanied him on occasion, but without any payoff, that had soon petered out. I positioned one of the drones in a tree along his usual route. The drone camouflaged itself so that it looked like part of the tree trunk. Even if Archimedes spotted it, he wouldn't think of it as anything but wood. The Delton language was far more guttural than anything humans could produce. I had set up a translation routine so I could converse in English without worrying about the fine details. Archimedes. Archimedes jerked and then went into a defensive crouch, looking wildly about. Don't be afraid. I want to help you and your people. Archimedes slowly straightened up but continued to search for the source of the voice.
Who are you? Where are you?
I'm farther away than you can see, Archimedes, and I'm the one who destroyed the gorilloid that was attacking you. I'm also the one who brought the flint. Archimedes' eyes lit up. Flint was priceless. I now had his complete attention.
What do you want?
I thought of all the ways I could answer that and decided to keep it simple. I want your people to leave this place and go back to one of the old villages. Archimedes' eyes went wide.
So, old Moses wasn't lying? There used to be other villages?
Yes, Archimedes. And some of them are better places to live than this one.
Some have flint?
Yes. And a better water supply, more food, and better defenses. His eyes narrowed.
If that's so, why did we leave there? Wouldn't that have been the place to stay?
I turned and grinned at Marvin. Kid's no fool, he said. It would have been, Archimedes, but your people weren't thinking of that at the time. Then it was too late, and they'd been driven out.
So, why tell me? Why not speak to the elders?
Would they listen to me? Archimedes had been searching for the source of my voice as we talked. Triumph lit up his face when he spotted the odd section of trunk.
You are a tree?
No, that's just where I am right now. Would they listen? He snorted.
Most of them are so stupid. They ask no questions. They have no answers. They just eat and sleep and hunt.
I spent a few more minutes discussing it with him. He finally agreed to go talk to the village elders, although he made me promise to show a sign of some kind if it became necessary. In response, I canceled the probe's camouflage and floated it over to him. How's this? Archimedes went rigid and his eyes became huge, but he managed to not bolt.
That works.
I watched from a distance as Archimedes talked to his elders, who sat in a semicircle facing him. It didn't seem to be going well. Despite all his recent accomplishments and rise in status, Archimedes was still just a juvenile. Even some of the other juveniles had started to laugh and make jokes. Finally, I'd had enough. I activated the probe and flew it over to hover above his head. The laughter and commentary cut off like a switch had been thrown. Archimedes was no dummy. The sight of the whole village staring at a spot over his head had only one possible explanation. In an impressive display of natural showmanship, Archimedes didn't look up or directly acknowledge the probe. He simply crossed his arms and looked smug. In the background, Marvin commented, "Some things just transcend culture." "Or species," I responded. The disintegrating gorilloid was still very fresh in everyone's mind, and the probe looked similar enough to the pieces of the buster to convince the Deltons. There was no backtalk after that. Archimedes explained to them what I'd told him. When he was done, Moses leaped to his feet and started yelling at everyone. It was pretty incoherent, but consisted mainly of variations on, "I told you so." Apparently, Moses' stories had been dismissed for years, and this was payback. Eventually, Moses' rant ran down, and the elders turned back to Archimedes. One of them, I decided to call him Hoffa, asked Archimedes if the floating thing would protect them from the gorilloids. Archimedes looked up at the probe, finally acknowledging its existence.
"It calls itself the Bob."
He looked around the circle.
"It can help, but there are few of them, and they are destroyed with each gorilloid they kill. They will guide, and they will help, but we must fight our own battles."
Arnold, who had been standing outside the circle and listening, chimed in.
"We fight here or we fight somewhere else. The Bob is right. This place is too open to defend, and I like the idea of more axes and spears."
He waved his axe around by way of emphasis, narrowly missing a few bystanders. The argument went on for hours. Inevitably, some people wanted to stick with the status quo just because it was familiar. They fought the plan tooth and nail, even at one point suggesting that they send a party of Deltans to scout out the other location. Arnold dismissed that idea with a comment that he didn't want to come home to a camp full of corpses. I looked over at Marvin. Jeez, this crap is universal. Yep, he replied. Politics is, apparently, politics through the whole universe. 45. Bill, January 2165, Epsilon Eridani.
Incoming Scout communication from Alpha Centauri.
Cool! I put down the file I'd been working on. Calvin or Goku?
Bart.
I raised an eyebrow at Guppy and got exactly the same reaction as always. I sighed and grabbed the connection. Bill here. Hey, Bill, this is Bart. I'm from Calvin's first cohort. Wow, this is really... I popped into Bart's VR. It was a little rude doing that without an invitation, but I always got a kick out of the surprised look on my face. I liked Bart's VR right away. He'd set up a rustic log cabin with a cast-iron wood-burning stove, a fireplace, heavy handmade furniture, and lots of rugs and blankets. It reminded me of a place my father used to take us for vacations when I was a child. Bart was sitting in the big old rocking chair in which Dad used to spend most of his time relaxing. He had the look. I mentally added another notch to my scut cabinet. Holy! I laughed at his boggled expression. Welcome to Bobnet. Instant communications up to about 25 light years. So, Bart, what happened to Calvin and Goku? Bart took a moment to examine the VR quality before answering. They all did that. The guys reconnoitered Alpha Centauri A and B exactly as set out in the mission profile. They found a Brazilian factory in full swing in A, and the wreckage of a USE probe and auto factory in B. I guess we can consider the USE probe accounted for. Bart did a half shrug. They executed a sneak attack on the Brazilian installation. The modifications for the version 3 Heavens are really effective, by the way, and wiped it out. Excellent. Any colonizable planets? No. Bart shook his head slowly. The system is great for resources and such, but nothing livable. And not completely excellent, by the way. One of the Brazilian probes got away, although we don't think it was completed yet, so it may be unarmed. And it may not have the autofactory equipment loaded in. I thought for a second. Not great news. Medeiros may try to hijack someone else's installation, or maybe skulk around for a while and then raid you guys. We set up early warning systems, not to worry, and we scanned the system pretty thoroughly. I think he'll head elsewhere. I shrugged. It wasn't worth dwelling on. We couldn't track him at this point, so we just have to wait until he showed up somewhere else. Anyway, Bart continued, Calvin and Goku set up a Bob factory, then left as soon as one of us was ready to take over. I built the scut when I received your transmission, and that brings us up to date. I accepted the folder that Bart pushed toward me and took a moment to scan it. Nothing earth-shattering. I was impressed, and a little smug, at how well the version 3 improvements had worked. Medeiros would have to significantly up his game if he wanted to compete now. I'm glad to see a Bob factory in operation, I said. I've been a little remiss in that department since I sent out the last group. I can feel less guilty now. Bart smiled in return. We spent a few minutes getting caught up, and Bart promised to pop by occasionally for a game of scrub baseball. With Bart and the other two Bobs currently being completed, we finally had enough to fill the positions all the way to the outfield. 46. Milo, August 2165, 82 Eridani. I decelerated smoothly into the 82 Eridani system. According to all the astronomical info, this was a very good candidate for a habitable planet. The star, a G5V class, was smaller and less luminous than Sol, but still well within the characteristics of yellow suns that human beings would prefer. I didn't want to get cocky, but I was anticipating having two good finds in a row under my belt. I doubted I'd ever get a chance to stamp a Brazilian silhouette on the side of my hull like Bob 1, but maybe a couple of planets with green check marks. Yeah, that's the ticket. I watched the survey results intently as the data slowly rolled in. Finally, Guppy announced pay dirt. Not one, but two planets inside the comfort zone. Although one was at the inside edge and the other almost at the outside edge, still, it was exciting stuff. And that would be four planets with check marks, thank you kindly. Impatient to pass on the good news, I aligned my comms array with Epsilon Eridani and began squirting telemetry back to Bill. I set a course toward the outer of the two planets, since it was closer. The planet had a large moon farther out and a smaller moon closer in. Strangely, the larger moon showed a blue color. I suspected that it might actually have open water. The planet itself definitely had large bodies of water. As I decelerated to place myself in a planetary orbit, proximity alarms sounded. It took me a moment to focus on the cause. Four missiles were coming around the curve of the moon, and they were accelerating aggressively. Crap! I turned tail and accelerated away, but it was obvious that they had far better legs. I did the calculations, examined alternatives, but there was no out. I was hooped unless I took out all four missiles. I took a moment to give my busters extra instructions to seek out a ship matching the Brazilian profile after dealing with the missiles, then launched all eight busters in the usual pairing strategy. As the busters headed toward the attacking missiles, my proximity alarms blared again. Four more missiles had appeared, coming around the opposite side of the moon. I was out of busters. With no chance of calling them back to me in time, I had to depend on my railgun. I did a quick computation. I'd likely get two, possibly three, but there just wasn't enough time to load the railgun fast enough to take them all out. Medeiros had outflanked me and done a good job of it. As I fired at the approaching missiles, I made sure the communications array was still lined up and squirted off a description of my situation and a differential backup. A calm part of my mind calculated that I wouldn't get it completed in time. Damn. The last two missiles filled my view. 47. Riker, January 2166, Sol.
They're dying, Colonel.
The Colonel wore his chin-out expression, a sure sign that I was in for a fight. In the last year, Vehement had started attacking food production and supply facilities. Most of their attempts were no more than token efforts, statements, really. But the last three incidents had taken out supplies that the groups in question couldn't spare. Now they were out of or about to be out of food with half the winter still to go. Barring cannibalism, we were looking at hundreds of deaths before spring. Unfortunately, the current political climate was short on empathy. A couple of failed groups, to most of the others, just meant slightly less competition for the emigration queue. The USE encampment, the Faith Enclave, and the Spitz were the richest in terms of food reserves, but they had made it clear that they weren't about to volunteer anything to help out. The Spitz in particular were trying to stretch their resources out for as long as they could. Their annual surpluses were swiftly being whittled away. They would be a have-not within a few years. 3 hours of negotiating, pleading, and threatening had accomplished zero. They knew I wasn't about to abandon them, so they were willing to call all my bluffs. In disgust, I finally cut off the video connection without so much as an over and out. Homer looked at me from his video window. He'd been following the whole thing.
Damn, number two. This is kind of a rock and a hard place situation.
I nodded glumly. For the moment at least, I was out of ideas.
It's going to get worse, Homer added. The climate isn't improving. A lot of groups are only surviving because of reserves of some kind. They're not producing enough food to get by.
Thanks, Homer. I needed that encouragement. Homer shrugged. To be fair, he probably wasn't trying to bait me.
What we need, Riker, is to go into the farming business or something.
We've been over that, Homer. We actually could establish farms in the former tropics, but they'd be good for maybe 20 years maximum, and we'd have to build the infrastructure. All the existing farming infrastructure is in the formerly temperate zones. Homer stared into space, rubbing his chin.
I keep coming back to space stations. Something itching at me.
I opened my mouth to object, and Homer held up a hand to forestall me.
I know Riker, too complex, not enough population density in a space station to make it worthwhile, too much risk. I just think we're looking at it wrong.
I gave a half shrug and started to respond when Homer yelled, "Crap!" and froze. I pictured Homer getting hit by a missile and had a moment of panic, but he came back right away.
"Arthur's dead."
Homer looked as angry as Homer ever did.
"And he's got the telemetry from the drones up Saturn way. He was working some wreckage when there was a nuclear detonation. I'm getting reports from drones farther away from it."
Homer sighed.
"Booby trap. No way to tell who set it up. I told him several times to watch for those. He got careless."
"Did he save a backup anywhere?" Even as I said it, I knew the answer. Making a backup and keeping it on board was easy, but pretty useless in a case like this. And we didn't have the space to save each other's backups. I had a to-do item to build some storage into the Sol space station for just this purpose, and like 99% of my to-dos, it was filed under someday. I took a moment to mourn for Arthur. Downer or not, he was one of us. Homer was looking at me expectantly, and I realized I was having trouble focusing. With an effort, I brought myself back on track.
"Okay, Homer, get the drones to recover what they can, and I'll go talk to the colonel. Looks like we're going to need to change the schedule again. We can't do without a fourth Bob, and I think we'd better build that storage matrix."
There's an alternative," Homer said. "We've got the printers from my Earth scavenging ops. I wouldn't say they're exactly idle, but at least Colonel Butterworth isn't leaning over them and steaming them with his breath."
I laughed at the unexpected imagery, and Homer was right. I nodded an acknowledgement to him and forwarded to Bill an in memoriam entry about Arthur for the archives. As soon as Charles was back in Earth orbit, we would have a wake. 48. Bob, May 2166, Delta Eridani. It took almost a month to get ready. The trek to the best village site would be long and arduous. From discussion with Moses, it seemed that it was one of the first villages to be abandoned, and, unfortunately, it was the one with the best supply of flint. Moses wasn't clear on why it hadn't been better defended. He apparently had been a young cub at the time, and most of his information from that era was secondhand. He'd been one of the last Deltans to be trained to nap flint before they were forced to leave. In any case, Marvin had surveyed the route that they would have to take. It would not be easy or quick. A mountainous spine ran down the center of this continent, and there were only a couple of passes that were low enough to be useful. During that part of the trek, there would be no local food unless the tribe got very lucky. I didn't know if the Deltans had lost the techniques for food preservation or if they'd never developed them. Before they could leave, I had to teach them how to preserve meat. The Deltans understood the benefit right away and took to it with enthusiasm. The Deltans worked to build up a larder for the journey. Once the decision had been made, everyone got on board, and with the immediate gift of knowledge that I'd brought, they began to trust that I was steering them in a good direction. Gorilloids were spotted on a number of occasions hanging around the edge of the Deltan territory. They might have been hoping for targets of opportunity, but they seemed to have had the stuffing knocked out of them in our last encounter. They didn't challenge any of the Deltan hunting parties. Of course, the sight of an occasional drone floating about might have had a little something to do with that as well. I was quite happy to put the fear of Bob into them. While I waited for the Deltans to finish their preparations, Marvin and I made sure we built some more busters. They were hardly an ideal weapon, about equivalent to fishing with dynamite, but they were better than nothing. Besides, they made up for their lack of precision with an abundance of theatrics. We also faced a breeding issue. Deltans, it turned out, had an annual breeding cycle, and a large number of mothers-to-be were coming up on their due date. The Deltans were rightly reluctant to move before the latest generation arrived. Archimedes' stock continued to soar with the other juveniles. He was, for all intents and purposes, now a member of the tribal council, something that even Arnold couldn't claim. I also noted in passing that Archimedes was now showing a lot of signs of Deltan puberty. Likely the next few years would see a whole bunch of mini Archimedeses running around. That was fine with me. There was a noticeable difference between talking to him and talking to most of the rest of the tribe. Finally, the day came.
The whole tribe lined up, packed their belongings onto several travois, another gift from the Bob, and set off into what was for them the great unknown. The gorilloids were in evidence on departure day, hanging around just out of range and watching the parade. I wondered if the gorilloids actually understood that their erstwhile prey was about to leave for good, or if they were just drooling over all that lunch on the hoof. Either way, the first gorilloid that made a move would get a buster in the face. I was lined up, ready, and just waiting for something to obliterate. The first night was a less-than-stellar experience for everyone. It rained heavily. I had to keep reminding myself that the Deltans were used to this. They didn't have tents, just sewn together skins that each family group would drape over itself. I resolved to introduce Archimedes to the concept of tent poles.
Better take it easy there, oh great one. Next thing you know, they'll be eating fast food and watching TV.
Marvin leaned back in his chair with his hands behind his head.
Seriously. It's not necessarily a good thing to throw too many new concepts at them at the same time. Floating metal deities seems to me to be more than enough for now.
Funny you should say that, I frowned in thought. Have you noticed they don't appear to have any concept of religion? Marvin waved a hand in the air.
There's some basic animism there in the form of things like honoring the animals they kill for food and venerating their dead. I doubt humans had much more at the hunter-gatherer stage.
He sat forward abruptly.
Hey, speaking of which, do you realize that we have the opportunity here to document their entire prehistory?
Well, from the time we got here, anyway.
Already started, Marv.
The camp seemed to have settled down for the night, so I deployed a couple of probes into guard positions and set up parameters to interrupt me. Security precautions complete, I swiveled to face Marvin.
I notice you've started a batch of Bobs at the auto factory. Not that I'm complaining, since that is part of our mission profile. I just wonder if you've changed your mind about hanging around.
He smiled at me.
Not immediately. Although I do feel an itchy foot once in a while. Like I said to Luke and Bender, I'm curious as to how this is going to turn out. But it is still your show. Maybe there's another planet of sentience out there for me.
I nodded thoughtfully. How about the planetary survey? Any other Deltans anywhere?
Nope. This continent is the cradle of humanity for the Deltans. Strictly a local mutation. There are lots of related species, but none that use fire or make tools.
I pulled up a globe of Eden and checked out the detail that we had amassed. It gave me time to think. I realized that the idea of Marvin taking off was unpleasant. Somehow, I was a little less of a loner than original Bob. I dreaded the idea of being on my own again. I sat back and looked over at Marvin, who was tinkering with his own copy of the globe. I sighed and cleared my holotank. The Deltan migration was still pretty close to the schedule. There had been no major glitches so far, and the tribes seemed to have settled into routines. I was not so relaxed. We were now well out of the territory of the gorilloids whose butts we had whooped. Any gorilloid in this area would only see a bunch of easy pickings. Accordingly, Marvin and I had doubled the number of drones on guard duty at night. So it was more than a little irritating that the attack came during the day. As gorilloid raids went, it was not particularly impressive. A dozen or so of the animals hit a straggling family group and made off with two juveniles before anyone could react. The Deltans reacted immediately, giving chase and trying to cut the gorilloids off from the forest. In this situation, a buster would be as big a danger to the two juveniles as to the gorilloids, so we settled for buzzing the animals with the drones, trying to confuse and distract them. It seemed to do the trick. Within moments, the Deltans caught up and skewered half the gorilloids. The rest fled into the trees with screeches of alarm. Unfortunately, one of the juveniles was dead. The gorilloid that had been carrying him had apparently taken the time to ensure he wouldn't struggle or escape. The Deltans were distraught and had a burial ceremony that evening. But interestingly, there was no talk of the migration being a mistake. If this had been humans, I was pretty sure there would have been all kinds of second-guessing and recrimination. But the Deltans just took it in stride. I couldn't decide if they were being philosophical or fatalistic.
You know, that's going to happen a lot more as we go on.
Marvin said to me. The gorilloids? Yeah, I know. Not a lot we can do during the day, though. Infrared is useless. Everyone is moving at different speeds most of the time, and the area we have to cover is just too large. Marvin sighed.
I know. It's just that even with the last round of births, this is still a small gene pool.
I nodded and thought about the problem. Hey, didn't you mention at one point that there were small, isolated groups scattered about? Maybe we should try to amalgamate them.
Not a bad idea. Good for both groups. Tell you what, I'll send up a high-altitude survey every night to look for other fires. If we find any, we'll send in the Bob to convince them to move.
I grinned at him. My reputation as godling wasn't getting me a whole lot of local respect, even from myself.
The migration had grown. Not only had we found several small groups and convinced them to link up, but apparently the parade was enough of a disturbance to be detectable for miles around. By the end of the first month, we had one or more groups join up almost every day. While there were often negotiation issues as different Deltans attempted to assert priority, those incidents generally ended without more than harsh words being exchanged. I had a feeling that the flint-tipped spears and Arnold with his big-assed axe contributed to that. Marvin and I tried to keep the drones out of sight, especially when there were noobs around. We didn't want to take a chance on scaring anyone off. Sooner or later, though, the topic would come up, or we'd have to fly in close for one reason or another. The results were usually pretty comical. Deltans didn't react any better to UFOs than humans would. The migration was up to well over 500 individuals. A very large portion of that consisted of females and juveniles. So Marvin and I heaved twin sighs of relief when the Deltans made it to the foot of the mountain pass. This part of the migration had its own dangers. The Deltans would be going well above the altitude of their preferred climate, so it would be colder than they were used to. They had no protection from either the weather or predators, and little or no available prey as they pushed forward. Before they started the climb, I made sure they re-inventoried their preserves. They would face a week or two without any other source of food. This was not the time to get sloppy. They started the climb first thing in the morning in order to get the maximum distance. I knew that they would slow down significantly through the days that the climb would take. They needed the best start possible. It took 4 days to get to the top of the pass. We'd budgeted for 6, so that was huge. The wind was god-awful there, though, so no one wanted to stop. They stretched that march well into the evening in order to get out of the wind tunnel at the apex. The trip down went faster, for obvious reasons. 3 days later, the migration streamed into forest again with some stored food left over. As a celebration, they camped for an extra day just at the edge of the forest. They took a break and feasted on the extra food. From here on in, they'd be able to forage and hunt. It took 2 more days for disaster to strike.
49. Riker, May 2166, Sol.
Firewall has blocked breach attempt.
I stiffened and turned to Guppy, the UN meeting forgotten.
What? Someone's trying to hack us?
Affirmative. Source appears to be the video feed from the UN meeting.
Ongoing danger? By way of reply, Guppy threw up a stack trace. I examined the listings. It appeared that the hacker was basing his attack on the basic Heaven design. The original Heaven vessels had no firewalling, relying instead on all communications being encrypted. However, it looked like the encryption routines had a back door. Someone had injected some packets, which had run right into Bob One's firewall. I made sure the UN communications system was logging all traffic. I would try the hack on Sandbox Bob later. There was little doubt in my mind that the attempt originated from the Faith Enclave, but I needed some kind of documentation before I made accusations. And there was the question of what could be done about it. It's not like there was a planetary police force to complain to. The UN meeting seemed to be all about routine matters today, so I decided to get an early start on the day's administrivia. The first item was a message from Homer. Just one phrase.
Space station!
Complete with exclamation mark. I couldn't see what he could add to the idea that would make it viable, but I would talk to him when I had a few moments. I glanced back at the video feed of the UN meeting, but still nothing noteworthy was happening. There was a message from Julia, fairly long, talking about family history. She seemed to have adopted me as a relative with no qualms. I was a little choked up about that, and I hoped she didn't send it just on Cranston's orders.
Source is New Zealand.
Guppy had traced the packets back to their originating stream. But New Zealand? That made no sense. It also meant that I wasn't going to have the proof I needed to really make Cranston's life difficult. Maybe I could bluff. Meanwhile, the hack attempt wasn't going to get anywhere, so I might as well just let the perp keep at it. I did a test ping at Homer, and he indicated he was free to talk. I took a moment to feel awe at being able to talk to him halfway across the solar system without any delay. We no longer had to worry about light speed lag. I popped into Homer's VR. Space station? Homer minimized the window he'd been looking at and turned to face me.
The answer to our problems, he said with a grin.
Not unless you have something new.
Just a new perspective, Homer replied. We've been thinking of space stations in terms of housing people. Of course that won't work. Gotta get the air right, the gravity right, extra shielding for radiation, extra armor for micrometeors, construction for living quarters, feed them, entertain them, yada, yada, yada. But the engineering is a lot easier if we don't try to house people.
Homer looked at me expectantly. Okay, Homer, I give up. We're going to raise cattle, or... My eyes went wide.
And the penny drops,
he said, pointing his index finger at me.
Farming. You just need enough spin to establish an up and down, so the structural strain you have to engineer for is reduced. The interior can just be one big cavern, and sunlight is available 24/7. Some equipment to make sure the air mix stays correct and the temps stay in range, and we're golden.
I thought about it. Plants take CO2 and produce oxygen. Any kid with a match can reverse that, but we need to produce calories in as dense a manner as possible. Got anything specific in mind? He gave me a thumbs up.
Damn right. Remember that library entry about gene-engineered kudzu? Improved nutritional content, simplified growth environment, human digestible,
and high sunlight requirements, and optimum temps in the 20 degrees Celsius range. Where are we going to find those conditions? Oh, wait, I grinned.
Yeah, and since we have access to the Svalbard vaults now, we can pick the cultivar that best matches the environment we end up with.
Homer hesitated and held up his index finger.
But kudzu needs a lot of water, so we'll have to constantly truck a supply up, unless we bring in some icebergs from Saturn
using the asteroid movers. I was becoming enthusiastic about this idea as we worked through the details. Which we can also use to bring in regolith for soil. Fertilizer will have to come up, but that's small potatoes volume-wise, especially once the operation gets going.
And the best part, Homer finished, is that the work can be done with my printers, the same ones that are building Arthur's replacement right now.
Homer's last comment made me think of Colonel Butterworth, and I groaned. The Colonel very likely wouldn't be mollified by that line of reasoning. To him, any equipment that could do something else could also work on his colony ships. Butterworth is still going to have kittens. Homer bounced up out of his chair.
This will be fun. Can I watch?
Not only did Butterworth have kittens, but the UN assembly went ballistic. Everyone except the groups that were facing starvation was beyond apoplectic and well into incoherence. I sat there, jaw-dropping, as people complained about criminal misuse, their words, of a resource that wasn't even part of the construction equation. Finally, I'd had enough. I signaled for the floor. Ladies and gentlemen, here's the thing. People are about to starve, and I mean within 6 months to a year. Those of you with reserves have refused to consider sharing, so that leaves it to me to fix things. This is a viable option, and it doesn't even affect the schedule. Yes, it affects future colony ships as we're using scavenged materials for space stations instead of colony ships. However, I'm willing to trade future colony ships against current lives. And by the way, some of you here will be depending on our kudzu gardens by the time your turn comes around, so let's not be too critical, okay? I turned off my mic, which was the video equivalent of sitting down,
and watched as the speaker was inundated with requests to speak. Unbelievable, this crap is universal. I was going through my daily round of calls, and naturally one was Cranston. Outstanding. On the other hand, I did have this hacking thing to talk to him about. I rubbed my eyes, got myself a coffee, then activated the connection. Good afternoon, Minister. Anything in particular you wanted to talk to me about?
In fact, there is, Mr. Riker. Today's session, specifically. While we are not the richest enclave on the planet, we do have some surplus.
He nodded an acknowledgement,
as you've taken great pains to point out on several occasions.
And you've refused to give any of it up, has something changed?
In a manner of speaking, since you have this kudzu idea, it seems to me that giving up some of our surplus would now be a temporary setback rather than a permanent crippling action.
I sat up straighter. Very likely there was a but in there somewhere, but the minister was at least sounding reasonable.
Of course, some quid pro quo would be in order as well, since you've already decided to put the Spitz in Ship 3, and the remaining space is just about right for our enclave. And without our surplus, we'd be part of the have-nots. It seems to me that we would be a reasonable choice for the balance of the ship's allocation.
The minister looked at me expectantly. I bristled at the implied request for favoritism, then had second thoughts. Everything he said was true, and while the Faith Enclave wasn't a shoe-in to be next in line, they weren't an unreasonable choice either, especially with any surplus gone. And rewarding such an overt display of cooperation would send the right message. I stared into space for a few milliseconds. Interesting. I would actually be displaying a negative bias by dismissing his proposal out of hand. Minister, that's a surprisingly reasonable proposal. I'll have to discuss it with my team, but it sounds like it'll fly. Minister Cranston managed not to look too smug. With a nod, he reached for the off switch. One moment, Minister, there's a small matter that I need to discuss with you. I filled him in on the hack attempt, leaving out any details of why it failed. Any thoughts on this? He was silent for several seconds, an eternity to me. When he spoke, he sounded uncharacteristically embarrassed.
I'm assuming, Mr. Riker, that the geographical source of the attempt is the only reason that you are asking instead of accusing.
He gave a small smile.
As it turns out, New Zealand makes sense. The fact is that our probe technology may not have been, entirely original faith research. Australia was working on the probe concept, and one of our agents may have, borrowed some ideas.
Espionage? You stole their plans.
Call it what you will. It's very likely that the Australian Federation has or had some very good insights into your original design, and New Zealand is where most of the survivors would have ended up once Brazil started dropping rocks on Australia.
He looked at me with his head cocked, the implication clear. Very interesting, and thank you for being frank about that, Minister Cranston. We said our goodbyes, and I sent a quick IM to Charles and Homer. Charles's response came back within moments.
I agree on the faith proposal. That also saves our relatives. I know you don't want to make that part of the equation, but I'm less worried about being impartial.
And from Homer.
Agreed. And the Australian explanation sounds reasonable. Cranston very rarely sounds reasonable. I hope he didn't sprain something.
I chuckled at that. Okay. Looked like we had a deal.
50. Bob, June 2166, Delta Eridani.
In retrospect, I guess we should have expected it. There had to be a reason why the Deltans had abandoned this side of the divide, despite the better locations and resources. And there was, in the form of gorilloids. The Deltan migration was large, noisy, and spread out. Like a traveling smorgasbord, they proved an irresistible attractant. The gorilloid raid struck early in the morning, after first light when the drone IR sensors had become useless. Of course, the gorilloids neither knew nor cared about that. They simply moved when they had enough light to see. The Deltans were half asleep, half organized, and totally unprepared. The number of attackers totally overwhelmed any defenses, and even took Marvin and me by surprise. They attacked on several fronts at once in classic pack-hunting style. They cut off individuals from the main group while keeping the defenders busy with feints. A dozen Deltons, females and juveniles, had already been grabbed. Fortunately, we had the busters on standby as a matter of policy. It took less than 10 seconds to bring them in. A dozen gorilloids disintegrated in claps of thunder. We had to select targets that weren't too close to Deltons, so this did nothing to save the abductees. That posed a separate problem. Guppy, put a drone on each Delton abductee. Stay with them no matter what.
Aye.
The buster attack froze the gorilloids and rallied the Deltons. With the flint-tipped spears, the defenders had the upper hand in close-quarters fighting.
There are too many. We just don't have enough busters. Marvin looked to me with panic on his face.
I turned to Guppy. The busters at the auto factory
are on their way. However, transit time will be almost a day at maximum acceleration.
We had started with 25 busters. We'd used up half of them in the first rally, and almost 50 gorilloids remained. I found myself frozen for several milliseconds. Marvin snapped his fingers.
Let's not use them all destructively. Hit the gorilloids at the speed of a thrown rock. A 40-pound steel ball will still slow them down. Then the Deltons can finish the job.
Do it.
We began hitting the gorilloids at low speed. Gorilloids were amazingly tough. A strike from a buster at that speed would kill a human outright, but the gorilloids were only stunned for a moment. In several cases, I found myself bludgeoning the same gorilloids multiple times. We were still losing busters. A unit could handle up to a dozen strikes before something malfunctioned. I made a mental note that we would have to figure out a way to collect the busters for repair, and quickly. Guppy, start the auto factory on building more busters, top priority, and send a couple of transport drones to the migration location.
Aye.
Eventually, the Deltan's defense gained the upper hand. The females and juveniles had packed into a dense mass in the middle, and the gorilloids couldn't get close enough to break off any stragglers. The defenders moved in organized groups and covered each other's backs. We were down to 6 busters and had to be very careful about conserving them.
Okay, Marvin, it's time to go after the abductees. Guppy, give us a rundown on locations and status.
Guppy popped up a relief map of the area with the location of Deltan victims and a tool tip beside each. It didn't look good. Over half of them were already being eaten. We each took 2 busters and went after the gorilloid groups. We'd smack the gorilloids in the back of the head until they either gave up and ran away or the victim got loose during the distraction. In the end, we saved maybe a third of the abductees. I flew a drone over to Arnold. There are people who are injured and can't make their way back to the tribe. You'll need to organize retrieval parties. Arnold gazed at the drone for a few moments, then started pointing to individual Deltons and giving orders. I had to hand it to the Deltons. They were a decisive race. When action was required, there was no backtalk. In moments, they had organized rescue parties who jogged off following the drones. I expected all but one of the surviving abductees to pull through, although some of them would have permanent disabilities. I sighed and looked at Guppy. How many to-dos do I have concerning teaching the Deltons some basic medical procedures?
26.
That's what I thought. I was scared to ask how many total to-dos I had stacked up. Not for the first time. I considered building a couple dozen bobs and attacking the list until it was under control. And as usual, I couldn't think of any items on the auto factory list that I could bump to make room. I'm sick of this. Guppy, I want the buster count up to 50, then I want you to pull 1 printer group and set it to building more printers. It's time to bootstrap.
Printer group duplication is time and resource intensive and will impact operations over and above the immediate loss of manufacturing output.
I know. Short-term pain, long-term gain. If we'd done this in the first place, we'd be breaking even now. It's time to get ahead of things. I turned to Marvin. I'm seriously considering constructing explosive armaments. His eyes went wide.
Wow, that's a hell of a concession. We hate explosives.
I know. Plus, there's a risk of blowing up the printer with each unit built. I'm thinking of building them the old-fashioned way. I'll build a chemistry lab, assign some roamers to it, and use industrial methods to build warheads.
You're talking about significant lead time.
Marvin shook his head, doubt written all over his face.
Yeah, but I have a bad feeling that we're going to be facing gorilloids for a long time. Run the numbers and calculate what the average population density has to be in order for them to be able to gather that many gorilloids together in so short a time. I think this side of the pass is gorilloid central.
Marvin stared into space for a millisecond or so, then nodded. I see what you mean. This is going to be a war of extermination.
After coming all this way, you want us to stop here?
The Elder's ears were sticking straight down in the Deltan equivalent of an incredulous stare. I looked around the tribal circle and saw the same expression on most of the faces. I sighed. The drone was not a great way to have a conversation. It might be impressive to a primitive people, but the lack of body language was really hampering me. I tried again. It's only temporary. I destroyed most of my busters. The translation program rendered that as flying rocks. In that attack, I need to build more. At least here, we've thinned out the gorilloids and put a scare into the surviving ones. Arnold, who was now a member of the circle, nodded in agreement.
It is true. The beasts will not attack again soon. They lost 3 for every person they took, and we got most of those back.
Sadly, although the gorilloids hadn't done well in terms of stealing a meal, they had managed to kill almost 20 Deltans during the attack. That was an unsupportable level of attrition. A few more attacks and we'd be back down below the numbers at the start of the migration.
How long?
The Elder wasn't conceding. He was asking for clarification. I wasn't anywhere near done here yet. 5 days. I have more busters on their way, and I want another set on hand before taking on more risk. After that, I'll be bringing in more as fast as I can make them. Arnold stepped in again.
This is not going to be over in a hand or two of days. For this many gorilloids to have shown up so fast, there must be many of them.
I spared a moment to be impressed by this observation. I looked at Marvin, whose eyebrows were climbing to his forehead. I guess that's a reminder, I said to him, that big doesn't mean stupid. This guy is sharp. I returned my attention to the drone. Correct. I'm running my flying rocks through the forests, counting up the gorilloids. Then we'll have a better idea of what we're up against, and maybe we can avoid the biggest concentrations.
Can you not just kill them before we get to them?
It was a reasonable question. I would be using up my busters killing gorilloids that might never bother us. Better to concentrate our energies on those who show up. I will, however, give more warning in the future. The Elders nodded. They understood scarcity of resources. Orders were given and people started to set up a more long-term camp. Arnold organized hunting parties, and I went looking for Archimedes to talk about tent poles.
It seems like a lot of work for not much benefit.
Archimedes examined his first attempt at a tent. Really, it was barely a lean-to. Your blanket isn't big enough to supply much coverage. With a larger blanket, you could make it tall enough to walk in and out, and you'd have sides to keep the rain and wind out.
Archimedes walked around it.
Hard to pack and carry. Hard to set up. It seems like something that would be more useful in a permanent camp.
Marvin laughed at the look on my face.
Take that, oh great sky god!
Shut up! I set aside the tent project and changed the subject to straightening spears. This was something that both Archimedes and Arnold were both enthusiastic about. They'd seen the difference that simply picking straighter spear shafts could make. The idea of taking almost any shaft and straightening it was a revelation to them. We talked for a while about how to steam the crooked piece of wood and how to build bending jigs. Arnold and Archimedes left to look for construction materials, the axe hanging casually across Arnold's shoulder. I rotated the drone to look over the camp. So many things to do. I might have forever, but these people? Not so much.
51. Bill. January 2174. Epsilon Eridani.
Message received from Milo.
I looked up, momentarily irritated by the interruption. I'd been going over growth projections for the mosses, lichens, and grasses that I was cultivating. I'd built one of Homer's farm donuts to grow as much base stock as I could manage before introducing it to the surface of Ragnarok.
He went to 82 Eridani, right?
Correct.
So?
Message contains a description of a very positive potential colonization destination. Message also contains a record of the destruction of the Heaven Vessel.
What? I filed my work, cleared my desk, and pulled up a message from the NQ. I could hear Milo's enthusiasm as he described the early survey of the system, and his fear as he relayed the information about the approaching missiles. There was a differential backup attached, but I had a bad feeling. Guppy, any chance on that backup?
Negative. The transmitted backup was cut off before completion.
Damn. There was a lot of information on this in the libraries. If I attempted to kludge something anyway, to forcibly restore him, basically, there was a very good chance that the result would be insane or simply non-viable. As sad as I was to lose one of us, I had no desire to see myself in that condition. Okay, Guppy. Archive the backup. Mark it in memoriam. We've got 4 version 3 Bobs being built right now, correct? At Guppy's nod, I continued. Start another 4 as soon as physically possible. Give all of them extra busters. We're going to extract payment for Milo.
Aye.
This Medeiros character was really turning into a thorn. First Epsilon Eridani, then Alpha Centauri, now this. Time to take out the trash. 52. Riker, January 2168, Sol. I popped into Homer's VR. Hey, number 3. Homer grinned back at me.
You know that'll never be as funny as number 2, right?
Eh, I shrugged. Now that you've gone all establishment, you need a nickname. I popped up the list he'd sent me earlier. You're really going for this ranch donut, aren't you?
Why not? We way over-engineered Farm 1 to the point of embarrassment, honestly. We've learned enough that I think we can give a half G at the rim without coming anywhere close to failure. And now that we've figured out atmosphere controls... He raised his eyebrows knowingly at me.
In fact, the first couple of months of Farm 1 had been a nightmare. Every aspect of the environment kept going into positive feedback loops. We'd ended up putting 4 full-time AMIs on the job until we were able to figure out how to dampen the resonances. Okay, General Bull Moose, just remember the little people, okay? Homer laughed, and I called up a coffee. Things were looking up. The donuts, as we'd taken to calling them, looked like fat bicycle wheels. Carbon fiber cables ran from the hub to the rim, providing most of the structural support. 3 thicker spokes provided elevator access from rim to hub. The donut was oriented perpendicular to the sun, and mirrors between the rim and hub reflected sunlight into the interior through the transparent roof of the rim. Everything was designed as simply as possible to minimize construction time and material requirements. I sipped my coffee in silence for a few moments. What I'm really liking is that Vehement can't get at these things. Sabotage-proof.
Unless they develop ground-to-space capability,
Homer replied in an offhand tone. I glanced at him, but I don't think he was suggesting it as a serious possibility. There had been more attacks on food supplies Earthside, and we'd been shifting supply schedules to compensate. The new farm would hopefully take the pressure off. Farm 1 was delivering raw kudzu on a regular basis, allocated by population and by need. I had been assured by Julia that no amount of inventive spicing could make kudzu anything other than, well, kudzu. Plus, it had digestive consequences similar to beans. Good time to be a replicant. Homer had come up with endless variations on the Beans, Beans song, some of which had caught on Earthside. The second space farm would be going into production in a week, and my calculations indicated that it would bring us into a comfortable food surplus situation for the next 3 years. After that, falling Earthside production would again become a significant issue. The third station, which was still about half finished, would be a mix of crops, both for dietary variety and nutritional health. Homer was talking about establishing ranching on the 4th one, cattle, pigs, and chickens. Sheep, if the New Zealanders didn't eat all the stock first.
There was genetic material in the Svalbard vault, but we would have to build the artificial wombs if we wanted to use that. Homer had turned into an industrial tycoon. He was understandably proud that his idea had worked, and so well, and it had become an all-consuming pet project for him. I finished my coffee and stood up. Back to the salt mines, I guess. Try not to blow anything up, okay? Homer saluted me with one finger as I popped out. 53. Bob. June 2166. Delta Eridani. The Deltans were attacked again before we pulled up camp, but not by gorilloids. I had become so obsessed with the gorilloid-Deltan struggle that I'd forgotten that this planet had a full-on ecosystem, as diverse and rich as anything Earth had ever produced. And that included more than one apex predator. In this case, the attackers were something that filled the same niche as a leopard or other jungle cat, except that this species hunted in small packs. They took down a hunter who had stepped a few paces too far from the group. The rest of the Deltans jumped to his aid and laid into the predators with spears. It was over in moments. Fortunately for the intended victim, I guess, the leopard analogs, I was not going to call them leopardoids, didn't kill their prey instantly. Like many big cats, their strategy was to get a death grip and suffocate the victim. The bad news was that the hunter was left with some pretty significant wounds. As they helped him back to the camp, one of the other hunters joked that he'd be entitled to one of the carcasses for being such good bait. "I really like these people," I said into the air. Marvin turned to glance at me. "Damn good thing, too. Otherwise you'd have to work up a fire and brimstone routine." Yeah. Brings up a point. I'm going to hang around and help them for a generation or so, but I'd better let myself fade into legend after that. I really can't afford to let them become dependent on me. Right. And that's probably when I'll take off. Marvin pulled up a star chart of the space around Delta Eridani. Places to go, species to meet. In the silence that followed, I reflected again on how little I looked forward to Marvin leaving. We'd diverged, since he was created, into two distinct people, but we got along, which wasn't a sure thing. I smiled to myself as I remembered one of Bill's transmissions detailing some of the fireworks of Riker and Homer's early days. Wish I'd been there for that. It sounded like a great show. With the arrival of the latest batch of busters, we were sufficiently up to strength to be able to risk resuming the march. I announced this to the Circle of Elders, but was careful to phrase it as information rather than as an order. I didn't want to fall into the trap of putting myself in charge of their fates, and I certainly didn't want the political fallout among the Bobs from creating that kind of situation. The Elders discussed things, then announced we'd be leaving the next morning. Departure went without a hitch. The Deltans had benefited from a week or so of rest. Most of the wounded were now mobile enough to keep up, and they had built up their supplies during the stop. I had doubled the overnight guard and had every single available buster in the air, ready for so much as a butterfly to twitch. Maybe the gorilloids felt the bad karma because they were nowhere to be seen. The going was slower than the first half of the migration. The land was a little rougher, and the forest verged on being jungle. We were on the south side of the mountain range, and the climate reflected the slightly more tropical latitude. On the minus side between that and the enforced stopover, we would arrive well behind estimates. On the plus side, it really didn't look like the approaching winter would be much of a concern on this side of the mountain pass. I decided to be philosophical about it. As the Deltans walked, I floated along beside Archimedes. He had recently become quite attached to one of the females from his cohort, whom I had named Diana. She was obviously afraid of me, but didn't want to look bad in front of Archimedes. She stuck as close to him as she could, while trying to stay as far from my drone as possible. It was a little comical, but I didn't give in to my more immature urges. At the moment, we were discussing medical knowledge and procedures. The Deltans were in the potion and poultice stage, and while I had no doubt that some of their concoctions had some medicinal value, I was pretty sure that some root wasn't going to fix a broken leg.
"Yes, I understand, Bob. You've brought enough new ideas that have worked. I'm willing to take your word for it.
Archimedes shrugged.
But the medicine woman has been doing things her way all her life. I'm not going to go head to head with her.
Okay, point taken. How about you introduce me to her, then? Archimedes nodded, then turned to Diana, who was somehow managing to look even more alarmed.
You don't have to come, she said.
I want to,
she answered.
Maybe she'll kill him.
Wow. Maybe I'd line up a buster or two for the meeting. We endured three more attacks before we arrived at the Flint site. None of them were as big as the first attack, and we only lost a couple of people overall. On the other hand, gorilloid losses were extensive, a fact that made me very happy.
We're going to hunt them out?
Marvin looked shocked. Hell yes! Take out gorilloids for miles around, I waved at the relief map. Thin them down to the point that the Deltans can handle them.
And what about when they repopulate? It'll just be the same thing all over again. You'd be better off to kill the ones that attack and leave the others alone. Eventually, you'll breed a type of gorilloid that doesn't like attacking Deltans.
I thought about that for a moment. You have a point. Well, we'll see how bad it is when we get to the site. It may need some upfront thinning just so the Deltans have time to sit down and eat in peace.
I hear that.
54. Riker, October 2170, Sol. Final assembly. Two magical words that sent a thrill through me. Homer, Charles, Ralph, and I drifted a half kilometer from the two ships. We'd all agreed that it was pointless to be physically present when a video feed from a drone was every bit as good, but we'd done the agreeing while rushing to be here in time for the event. So much for logic. Even Colonel Butterworth had talked about taking one of the shuttles up to watch, but he'd eventually regained his senses. As the ships had approached completion, we deliberately adjusted construction resources to bring their status into sync. Both ships were now complete, except for the final connection of the drive rings to the hull.
Damn, dude. We've actually done it!
Homer's voice was filled with the sense of awe that we all shared. For someone who grew up in the 20th and 21st century, this was by far the largest single engineering project ever undertaken. I couldn't help thinking of the Utopia Planitia scenes in the Star Trek movies when a starship was being constructed. This had much of the same flavor. I looked over at the summary window. Every UN delegate was online streaming the video. The UN had had a rare rush of common sense to the head and decided not to make speeches. I suspected that the fact that every single one of them would want to make a speech had figured into that. It would have worked out to about 8 hours of speeches. Kill me. And finally, the construction AMI reported that all connections were successful. The two colony ships, officially Exodus 1 and Exodus 2, were complete. I was surprised to find myself tearing up. Okay, maybe not all that surprised.
So now what, Will?
Julia was surrounded by several members of her family in the video window. Conversations with the famous ancestor had become a regular thing at the Hendricks household. There were always people entering and exiting the video window. I didn't mind at all. The sight of my sister's